Talk given Friday, 1st August 1980. We all know that the religious life aims at releasing us into our full, true humanness, which means, in the ultimate, union with transcendence itself, the complete unio mystica as a continual state which is not entered into at a particular moment or a particular time, but which remains as a permanent background, the state of realization of ourselves as part and parcel, integral part and parcel of transcendence itself. Now, the old Vedic teachings named transcendence in two ways, Brahman and Atma. As you know, Brahman is the objective term and Atma is the subjective term. And of course, the Upanishads taught many, many things regarding the mind and its discipline, and how the mind is the obstruction in us to that realization. And by purifying the mind completely, living the life of utter purity, that very same mind is the means through which transcendence is realized. Now, therefore, it becomes important for us to understand the way our mind works. And what is it that obstructs the mind, stands in the way, clutters up the mind, and so forth. Now, in the Mundaka Upanishad, which is a very important Upanishad, one of the major ones, as they are called, it is stated that that subtle Atma, transcendence itself, subjectively regarded, is to be known by thought, wherein the senses fivefoldly have entered. And it goes on to say, the whole of men's thinking is interwoven with the senses. When that is purified, the Atma shines forth. Now, let us look at this very first sentence. That subtle Atma is to be known by thought, and the word used is chetas. The Sanskrit word is chetas. Now, thought is a possible translation, but the word chetas also means many things. It means consciousness, intellect, senses, mind, will. You see? But I think if we consider it from the in the meanings of consciousness and to a in a secondary degree intellect, we will get nearer the real significance of this statement, that subtle Atma is to be known by thought. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the longest of the Upanishads, it is stated that it is unthinkable, it cannot be known by thought. And yet, that same Upanishad also declares that it is only because it is set in thought that it can be realized. And therefore, the whole process of the discipline of the mind emerges out of that teaching. Now, get back to this chetas as consciousness, intellect, the senses, mind, and will. The word chetas is allied to the word chit, which means attention. Consciousness and intellect working in harmony implies complete attention, complete attentiveness. And in complete attentiveness, the word thought has a utterly different meaning. You know how in the various religions of the world, it is said that the whole universe is the result of the thought in the mind of God. The result of thought in the mind of God. And that thought is represented symbolically by the word, the logos. That is the real meaning of the word logos, the thought in the mind of God. Now, God being understood as the all-creative power, the primordial creative energy or creative power. And in the Trismegistic writings, of course, it's referred to as all-father mind. This is very interesting. All-father mind. One sees a correspondence, a relationship with the Buddhist teaching of mind as such, that mind is the originator of everything. The Buddhist teaching doesn't present God as a personal being, other than the creator who is other than the created, namely oneself, the human being, and so forth. The thought in the mind of God. Now, this thought is obviously quite different from what we mean by the word thought. What we mean by the word thought is the activity of our brain. And it is essentially a talking activity. It's silent chatter. This is what we call thinking. You will find that if you sort of observe, watch our whole thinking process, we are talking all the time. Talking silently to ourselves. That is thinking. Some people say, oh no, I don't think in words. They say, I think in terms of pictures. Or just a series of impressions. But how do we know those pictures? How do we know those impressions? Immediately it is translated into so many words. A series of pictures, you don't know the picture unless you talk about it in words. See, you look at that portrait and you say, oh, it's the portrait of so-and-so. It's a fine portrait, it's a remarkable piece of work, it's got the eyes like this and the nose like that, and also exact and so forth. There are words straight away, you see. So that we can never avoid. Then it's the same with tunes, with music, or with any sort of sensational expression. Finally, in finality, it is our faculty of speech which plays a very, very important part in understanding the whole situation. This is our thought, our what we call creative thinking as such, is the result of the formulation in terms of various sense impressions of what we call inspiration. The wordless, shapeless, formless, unpictured inspiration, which moves us, which affects us in such a way that ultimately it comes out as poetry, music, whatever it is, but there are always words attached to it, where inspiration is concerned, ultimately. In terms of concrete expression, that is. So now, that is our thinking. That sort of thing is our thinking. And obviously this thought in the mind of God as a creative power is something utterly different. No amount of thinking on our part will produce anything at all. It will lead to the production of things because it will help us to understand how to deal with matter in order to produce something. All right. That is quite different from the activity of a transcendent energy which in an inexplicable way produces manifestation. Space, time, matter, they all come out of this primary activity of consciousness itself, which is primordial creative energy, which is the creative power. They are all a unity. Primordial creative energy, absolute or pure consciousness, and bliss. They all three are one and the same identity. So, in this statement in the Mundaka Upanishad, that subtle Atma is to be known by thought, chetas, wherein the senses fivefoldly have entered. Now, that obviously means that all our thinking which takes place, whatever form that thinking takes, all our thinking is the result of sense impressions which have been synthesized in ourselves by the brain and presented as this, that or the other thought structure. You see? Fivefoldly have entered. Well, obviously refers to the five senses, sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell. That is, they could have just as well have said sixfoldly, because the Upanishads regarded the thinking process as such, as a sixth sense. They regarded it as material. They regarded what all over the world today we call thought not as mental but as matter, material. That's a very interesting point. They regarded it as matter. So they could have said sixfoldly, but five is troublesome enough to deal with. Therefore, we'll see that all our thinking is influenced by, it is conditioned by, the activity of our sense organs. And the activity of our sense organs is related to, dependent upon, matter, things, events, all that happens in the world in which we live. That which is associated with the living body, the physical body, and the physical world is what produces all our thinking as such. You see? Then they're going to say the whole of men's thinking is interwoven with the senses. So you see, this conditioning process plays the primary part in all our thinking. Our thinking is not, our thought is not an absolutely pure thought which is not dependent upon things or events or circumstances or anything that is manifested. That is to say, anything that begins, proceeds, and dies. Everything that is mortal, everything that is of the nature of illusion, delusion, of the nature of impermanence, affects our thinking as such. So you have in the Buddhist teaching the three signs of being as anicca, which they translate as impermanence, literally the non-eternal, nitya, the Sanskrit from which nitya is the Pali. Nitya means eternal. And if it is eternal, it is self-subsisting, it is self-replenishing. It is independent of anything and everything else. In Christian theology, you find God as the absolute, presented as independent, self-subsisting, existing by virtue of his own eternal being as such. The world is contingent, dependent upon this ultimate supreme creator. So, our thinking being of this sort, it is not the sort of thinking which can release us out of our limited awareness of the nature of existence, out of our limited mortal awareness, into the immortal awareness of the total reality, of transcendence itself. We function in terms of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. But man can be the instrument through which the infinite, the eternal, the immortal can manifest itself. The absolute, if you like. So, when the release takes place, we become capable of producing a thought which is totally independent of all the constricting influences upon us. That thought is not produced by our brains. Our brains, our physical brains, can only confine us to what to our sense impressions and to the world as apprehended through our sense functions as such. We must bear that in mind carefully. Now this implies that some change has to take place which can be brought about through our efforts, by the way we live our life. And it is this which constitutes the deep, truly religious living. And that religious living consists essentially of becoming so aware of all our defects, what the Buddha called the defilements of the mind, becoming so aware of all of them that they drop off, like scabs drop off from the skin, you see, they drop off. And the purification of the whole mind takes place. That is to say, it's the purification of the psyche which takes place. The mind is being the universal, the infinite, is pure to start with. There is no purification of mind as such. It's a purification of the psyche. That is to say, mind as it functions through us as psychophysical organisms. It's the psychical part of our psychophysical organism which determines the shape and form and expression of all our mental processes, our intellectual as well as our emotional, our feeling processes as such. So now, this purification through careful observation of all that goes on as a result of the activity of the brain. The brain never stops. It's everlastingly chattering. Even in sleep, it's only in complete unconsciousness, if there is such a thing as complete unconsciousness, that the accumulated, conditioned beliefs, ideas, convictions, thoughts, everything which is bound up with the brain, that has to stop, so that the psyche becomes completely empty. It becomes utterly transparent to the light of transcendence itself, the luminosity, if I may say so, of the void. Because, as we know, physically too, light travels freely through space and reaches us. And empty, what we commonly call empty space, is a transparent void. If it were not transparent, if it were even translucent, the light that we experience would be something quite different, because it's only translucent. There's a certain vagueness about that kind of light. You know, that kind of glass in a door which prevents anybody being able to see through that, and so forth. It keeps us invisible to somebody outside. That is translucence, which is different from transparence. You see? So, when the brain is completely quiet, you can't throw out of the brain already established memories, beliefs, and so forth, because the brain cells hold them constitutionally. They hold them as such. But they can be quietened, they can be allowed to simmer down, to become completely quiet. And this is the result of total attentiveness. This is where the power of attention, chit, comes in. You know how the Upanishads talk of Brahman in terms of Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat, the real, the absolute being, if you like, pure being. Chit, complete attention, complete consciousness. Chit is the word which is the Sanskrit that should be used if one translates not a sparrow falls to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Because the Father in heaven is all chit, all attentiveness, that kind of attentiveness, that transcendent attentiveness. So that with the quietening down of the brain, the purification of the psyche takes place. And this is, of course, the result of being permanently observant. One has to be observant all the time. And observant, this observation reaches a pitch where one is no longer conscious of oneself as the observer. I am looking at this thought, or that feeling, or that action. It's not a, there is only a looking. There is no awareness of I, a separate entity, a self, looking on at what is going through the whole psychophysical organism. I mean, these are very difficult things. We don't do these things. We are not able to do these things. And so many good people imagine that they enter into various jhanas and whatnot when they are just deluding themselves. They are kidding themselves, to use a slang phrase, all the time. So now, when this turmoil of the brain activity, which is tied up with the functioning of the senses and all the sense impressions and so on, when that completely quietens down, then pure mind as such, pure mind is indefinable. We don't know what it is. We can't start talking about it and saying, this is pure mind or something. We just have to postulate it, pure mind. Then pure mind functions through the psychophysical organism. And the whole procedure of that functioning will emerge as thoughts and feelings and words and actions as in the ordinary way, but of a nature which is utterly pure, which is completely sanctified, if you like to put it like that. Completely sanctified. And that will represent the state where the Atma shines forth. Because in that condition, there is the full awareness of the reality, the truth. And as you see, it will be formless and shapeless. It will be unconditioned, free of all the limitations that are imposed in terms of form, shape, expression, and so forth, by the activity of the senses and associated with the interpretation of the brain. All that is out. And then that's a completely different state of consciousness. A state of awareness, of consciousness, which is utterly blissful. And there one knows the true meaning of bliss. We know the meanings of joy, of happiness, of pleasure, and so on. But of that divine bliss, we don't know the meaning at all. But that is associated with that state. That is also the state of nirvana. Nirvana, or the kingdom of heaven, if you like, that all shines through this completely purified psychophysical organism. And that means that the Atma shines forth. Now remember that the Atma, or Brahman if you like, is associated with what the Buddhist would call the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, the transcendent, in other words, you see. It is, to use modern language, it is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And that manifests through what was the limited human being in the past. That is to say, whilst one advances towards that stage, towards that state. So now, looking again at the significance and the meaning of the religious life, it always comes to the same thing. I mean, every talk which deals with that will necessarily have these things as the central core of whatever is presented. The modes of presentation will naturally sort of vary, because one can express the one thing in so many ways. A potter makes all sorts of pottery. He makes hundreds of articles out of the same one thing, the clay. It's like that. Out of that come all the pots. So out of that ultimate, the Atma or Brahman or the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, emerges everything else. I think we might stop there today.